Our next speaker is Pekka Gronau. He's the head of the record archive of the Finnish Broadcasting Company. He has a PhD in ethnomusicology from the University of Tampere. He has written extensively on the recording industry. This summer, Castle in London's publishing his International History of the Recording Industry. Today he's going to be talking to us about reissues and copyright, the European situation, which will dovetail nicely, I think, into our copyright discussion after the coffee break.
Good morning, everybody, and perhaps I should start by telling you my interest in this subject. Those of you who know me know that I'm no lawyer, but as part of my job at the Finnish Broadcasting Company, I have to supervise and administer music copyrights. Our company pays about $15 million in royalties for the various collecting societies representing musical rights. And we don't want to pay anything for something that is in public domain. So I have learned the hard way to find out what's protected and what is not. My subject here is European copyright law, and especially as it relates to reissue of old recordings. But copyright is such a complicated subject for those who are not professional lawyers that I think it might be useful to get a little background on what copyright is and how it developed and why it differs from one country to another. You know that in the history of law, the idea of copyright is a relatively recent invention. It grew out of the invention of the printing press. Before that time, if I had a book and somebody took it from me, it was just like if he stole a piece of bread from me. The same law applied. But what happened if I was a printer and I printed a book and I sold it to somebody and the guy took it and copied it and reprinted 1,000 copies of the same book? If I went to him and complained, he told me that, "What's the matter? I paid you for the book. It's mine to do whatever I want to do with it." Of course, it couldn't go on that way. And so the idea of intellectual property was invented. But various countries developed this idea in different ways. In the UK, the United Kingdom, and historically the same idea was carried on to American law, copyright was seen primarily as the right of the printer, the publisher. In those days, not just anybody could set up a print shop. It was a privilege you could have in the 16th and 17th centuries. You had to apply for a grant from the king or whatever, and part of your privilege was that you had exclusive right to print whatever books you were printing. Meanwhile, in France, after the French Revolution, lawmakers became more concerned with individual rights. A man had the right to life, a right to property, and he also had the right to his intellectual creations. And so the French idea of droit d'auteur, the author's rights, became the nucleus of a European continental copyright thinking. In practice today, the results, how the law works, are often the same, but there are some basic differences. For instance, Anglo-American copyright law sees no problems with giving copyrights to legal entities, to corporations. For instance, if a British company hires a composer to write music to a film, the copyright owner is the company because it's work made for hire. In continental law, this is an impossible idea. A legal entity cannot create anything. It must always be a human author who creates a work which is his property. He can then sell, write the work or partial rights to the work to a publisher and so on. But the idea is different. Also, under the droit d'auteur concept, authors can have some rights which they cannot sell ever for any money, their moral rights, and which in some cases survive their economic rights. Okay, that was the part of birth of copyright, and already at that time copyright laws were quite different in the Anglo-American and in the continental European world. But then technology developed and new uses for works were invented. And copyright grew out of an interaction between legal principles and practical problems. First, you had translations. Did copyright cover translations? Yes, very soon they figured out that it had to. But did copyright also cover a public performance of a work? If somebody was reprinting Victor Herbert's music, that was a breach of copyright. But if somebody was just playing it, what was the problem? Of course, it was a problem, and so the authors' rights societies were founded at the turn of the century. And then film was invented. In the Anglo-American world, usually the copyright owner was the film company. In the rest of the world, it was seen as a film was seen as a work of joint authorship, and it was the director and the writer and the composer and perhaps the main photographer who were the joint authors. So far, so good. But then sound recording was invented. First, the record companies did not even want to pay composers for the music because they said that this is not a reproduction of the sheet music, but that was solved fairly early. But did the record companies have any rights of their own? It took quite a while to develop the idea of the rights of the performers and record companies. And again, you see that this took different ways. In the UK, which was incidentally the first country in the world to expressly grant rights to sound recordings apart from the works performed, this was seen as a kind of new work, like a film. And it was the record company which was the copyright owner. But this idea was completely impossible for the French, German, Scandinavian school of copyright thinking. And when these countries finally hit on the right way to protect recordings, it was by inventing the concept of neighboring rights. A performer who performed music had a right which was not a copyright, but it was something related to copyright. And in most of Europe today, the rights involved in sound recordings, apart from the work recorded are understood as neighboring rights or related rights. It's common to both of these types of rights that they are of limited duration, but they are constructed in quite different ways. And I'll come to this, back to this in a little while. In the course of time, different countries had arrived at different solutions to copyright problems. So the details of the protection given varied greatly, and what was protected was also different. It's interesting that in Brazil, for instance, you could copyright football matches because it was seen as such an important intellectual creation that it needed copyright protection. But and so there are very interesting details like that. But on the other hand, there were forces working in the other direction towards the unification of national copyright laws. Because a lot of what goes on in the publishing worlds, and later on in the film production, in the record industry and so on, it's international. And you have to know what happens if your works are performed in another country. If a work by Sibelius is performed and recorded in Finland, which law do you apply, the law of Finland or the law of the United States? Fairly soon, will you have the next one? The countries, or the main countries of the world, hit on the idea of national treatment. Lift it just a little bit. Most of the countries which had copyright laws agreed that the works of foreign authors would be given the same protection that the law of a state grants to its own nationals. So if a work of Sibelius is published in the United States or performed here or recorded here, US copyright law will apply. But vice versa, if the works of Charles Ives or Irving Berlin are published or performed in Finland, Finnish law applies. This was the main principle of international copyright agreements, but it was also agreed that certain minimum rights had to apply in all countries. If Brazil was willing to give protection to football matches, that was all right with them. They can do that if they want to. But all countries had to give the minimum protection for a certain number of years to, let's say, novels, compositions, and so on. And so this tended to unify copyright laws. You have the next one. But here again, a very complex network of international agreements developed. The Berne Convention, now more than 100 years old, has the widest membership. Today, practically all the countries of the world are members. But it does not cover the so-called neighboring rights at all. It does not apply to sound recordings, only to musical compositions, literary works, films, and so on. The Rome Convention, which was created expressly to protect sound recordings, was signed in 1961, much later, by a small number of countries. Today, growing number of countries are members, including Canada, since this year. But the United States of America to this day has not signed the Rome Convention. The main reason is that I think that it gives certain rights to radio stations vis-a-vis record companies vis-a-vis radio stations, which have not been acceptable to the United States. And so another convention, like a cut-down version of the Rome Convention, had to be created so that the U.S. could also join. This, it would take a whole day to go through all this, but this is some of the background. There are many similarities in copyright laws and certain binding agreements, but they are not universal. Okay, let's look like now at the, can we get the first one in more detail at the rules involved. For most sound recordings, there are two sets of rights involved. There's usually always a copyrighted work, or a work that could have been copyrighted previously, which is performed. The Finlandia, or Carry Me Back to Old Virginia, or whatever. But then there are the rights of the performers and the record company. The rights are valid only for a limited period of time. And for the rights of authors, the period today in most countries of the world, including United States, since very recently, I think this year, an amendment was made. All works are protected for 70 years from the year of death of the author. Can I have the next one? Okay, one more.
Duration?
Yes. Yeah. The trick to remember here is that in case of joint authorship, which is common in music, works which have a lyricist have two authors, and it's the one who lived longest who determines how long a work is protected. So, for instance, you know that Jean Sibelius, the Finnish composer, died in 1957. So his works will be protected until 2028. But the choral version of Finlandia has lyrics by the poet Koskenniemi, who lived longer than Sibelius. He died in 62. So Finlandia, in the choral version, will be protected until 2032, while the orchestral version will be in the public domain in 28. But when we are dealing with sound recordings, the rights of the authors are not so decisive, because it is a practice that these rights are administered by societies, so-called collecting societies, which represent practically all the compositions in the world. And if you want to record Finlandia in the United States, you don't have to go to the estate of Jean Sibelius or his publisher in Finland. You go to the Harry Fox agency here in the United States, and for a set fee, you can record Finlandia as many times as you want to. and it would be a restraint of trade if they would refuse you. In most cases, I think, I won't go in detail to this. The duration of neighboring rights is a bit more complicated, and let's look at it now. There used to be a great deal of variation in neighboring rights protection, in even in European countries. Some countries had 20 years, Finland had 25 years, Sweden had 50 years, and so on. And how the period was counted, it was also different. But since 1995, the European Union, which most Western European countries are members to, passed a directive which is binding to all member countries, setting down this rule. Sound recordings are protected for 50 years from the year, actually from the end of the year when they were made, or if released during this period, 50 years from the end of the calendar year when they were released. And this rule applies for all sound recordings, not only for commercial recordings. It applies for private recordings, broadcasts, or so, and so on. So anything that was recorded before 1948, which was first published, or let me put it differently. If something was published, recorded more than 50 years ago and not published, it's now in the public domain. It was recorded in 47 but published last year. It will be published, it will be protected 50 years from the year of first publication. But if it was never published and 50 years passed, it will be permanently in public domain. But the main rule here is that if you count from the year of first publication, and broadcasting counts as publications as well, because all broadcasts are by definition public. So any recording published more than 50 years ago is now in the public domain. For those recordings which are still protected, the situation is more complicated. If you want to find somebody and acquire the rights to re-release the recording. In the Scandinavian countries, for instance, the right belongs jointly to the performers as a kind of semi-authors, and the record company or institution or whoever who caused the recording to be made. But in the United Kingdom, it's the record company which is the owner, and in the United Kingdom they say copyright owner. This is has an interesting application in natural sound recordings. Animals don't have rights or sound effects and so on. So in case there are no human performers involved, it's the producer. In Finland, there's another catch as far as the performers are concerned. The law says that the performer performing a work, it doesn't have to be in copyright, it can be in public domain, is protected. But ordinary talk is not a work in the legal sense. So not everything a person says isn't automatically protected. So a human sound is not in all cases protected, but then the rights belong to the producer. Yes?
Performers, what about orchestras? Is the orchestra as a corporate entity that holds it?
No.
All the members.
Remember the European idea of the individual as the originator of rights. On the side of the performers, it has to be individuals who can then pool their interests and dispose of them collectively and so on, sell them to somebody, to a record company and so on. Okay, the conclusion of this, the next one, is that as far as the neighboring rights, as we call them, are concerned, any recording which we know was published in the year 47 or broadcast in the year 47 or in whatever way was made public at that time, that will say more than 50 years ago, is now in the public domain and will permanently remain so. Only by adding new sounds to the recording can you renew the neighboring rights, but not if you restore the recording, because then you are not adding anything, you are just trying to make it sound like it did in the first place, which was the performer's intention. And now if I look at this from the viewpoint of the reissue producer, of course, if it's a classical work, let's say Beethoven, that will also be in public domain. So a recording of a Beethoven piano work made in 46 is now completely in public domain. I can do whatever I want with it, as long as I don't hurt Beethoven's moral rights, which is a tricky issue. He still has them. And if the work is protected, I can just go to the organization representing it in the respective country. In Finland, it is Nordic Copyright Bureau, and tell them that I want to record this work for the established rate, and they will have to issue me a license. The tricky exceptions here might be works which have never been published before, especially if they are on private recordings, so that the recording has not been published either, or complete recordings of operas or ballets or and so on, so-called, which carry so-called grand roar, major rights, which is a very complicated side issue. But even in that case, if the work is in public domain, it remains so. Yes.
You say voluntary licensing. We call it compulsory licensing.
That's different. Compulsory licensing applies for playing a record on the radio, because compulsory means that
you have to do it. You're compelled to do it. But that's what our mechanicals are.
Yes. But in Europe, it's not compulsory. It's not U.S. copyright law differs in this respect.
So that is different.
Yes, but
it looked like it was the same.
In practice, it is, because there are restraint of trade considerations here, which made once a voluntary license is a binding agreement made by organizations representing rights owners and to the organization representing it in the respective country. In Finland, it is Nordic Copyright Bureau, and tell them that I want to record this work for the established rate, and they will have to issue me a license. The tricky exceptions here might be works which have never been published before, especially if they are on private recordings, so that the recording has not been published either, or complete recordings of operas or ballets or and so on, so-called, which carry so-called grand roar, major rights, which is a very complicated side issue. But even in that case, if the work is in public domain, it remains so. Yes.
You say voluntary licensing, we call it compulsory licensing. Is
that that's different. Compulsory licensing applies for playing a record on the radio, because compulsory means that
that's what our mechanicals are.
Yes, in Europe it's not compulsory. It's not U.S. copyright law differs in this respect.
So that is different.
Yes, but
it looked like it was the same, I think.
In practice it is, because there are restraint of trade considerations here, which made once. A voluntary license is a binding agreement made by organizations representing rights owners and organizations representing users. And when such an agreement has been made, it applies to everybody, even people who were not party to the original agreement. But the rights owners are not obliged by the law in the first place to enter this agreement. Okay, this was the main point of my presentation, but I'd like to continue for a little while, if I may. Okay, yes, that will do. For reissues, the case is relatively simple. But what about other uses of sound recordings, for instance, on the internet? There the situation can be much more complex. For instance, at the moment there is no voluntary license agreement for putting music on the internet. So it's a whole new ball game. Another side to this is that there's a clear tendency by rights owners to extend neighboring rights protection. After all, 50 years is not so much, and most of us will, during our lifetime, see Elvis Presley and the Beatles and so on falling into public domain as performers. If you look at, if you read the Rome Convention, it says that the year of publication from which the clock starts to tick, 50 years, is marked by a small p on the record and the year. If you look at reissues nowadays, and if there's King Oliver CD issued today, it's not P98 and it's not P23 like it should be. Mm-hmm. It's P98, and I'm pretty convinced that in a while a discussion will arise that the protection should be counted in a different way, that reissues are so different from the originals that they count as new works. In the United Kingdom, I think you could even today make a case for this in the courts, saying that the record company has created a new artifact which is different from what Jeanette did in 23. You can't do this in Finland, because you would have to bring King Oliver up from his grave and blow his horn again to give new life to the copyright. But that will be interesting to see how this will go on in the future. But for the moment now, I'll thank you for your attention.